Good afternoon and welcome once again to this week's What Comes Next Live. Through serendipity and a prior guest, Ian Sanders, my guest this week is Simon Roberts and his cat.
And his cat.
So I've looked Simon up a little bit in the few minutes for the show, and I'm fascinated to learn from him. Perhaps one thing I'm keen to learn about is anthropology, and how that informs how we learn and how that informs how we lead, because my overarching theme is leadership. So Simon, over to you.
Oh God. Well,
who are you?
Who am I? I am indeed Simon. I call myself a business anthropologist. I lay claim to that title because I've been doing anthropology in and of businesses for, this is my 22nd year actually. So for some amount of time. And that, as indicated, involves either doing kind of research for businesses, with their users, consumers, audiences, citizens, depending on what terminology you want to use. And it all has also meant over the years doing research within businesses. And the best sorts of projects often combine the two, because in my view, the very best way of making sure that insight about the outside world lands within a business is to understand what sort of organization, what sort of environment, what sort of stories that business tells itself about itself. So, you know, it's almost like plowing a field, making sure that it's ready to accept the seed and that the seed will sprout into something useful. So that's sort of what I do in a nutshell, but we can maybe talk a bit more about that.
Let's maybe strip it back a bit, because I do have a fairly widely varied, and my overarching theme is what I call open leadership, and it's about learning and curiosity and all of that. Let's strip it back to basics. What's anthropology, and why should we care?
Why should you care? So Margaret Mead said the job of anthropology is to make the world safe for our habitation of it. What is anthropology? Anthropology is the study of what used to be called the study of man, capital M, but it's really the study of people. Mm-hmm. It's the study of how they make meaning, how they use the material world around them to create meaning, to encode ideas. It's about how people organize themselves, so social structures, and, you know, the symbols that get attached to those structures, those forms of organization. So another anthropologist talked about us spinning webs of meaning, and that mm-hmm. and that humans are suspended within the webs of meaning that they've themselves spun. And so anthropologists try to make sense of that. How do we make sense of how other people see the world? That's the mm-hmm. job.
Okay. So I'm a recovering chartered accountant. The first step is admitting you have a problem, which is what I normally say if I stand up in pre-COVID days, stand up in front of rooms of professionals. And that's all about numbers.
Yeah.
My obsession the last 15, 20 years was when I realized there weren't enough numbers out there to measure how business operates, because a phrase I use often is business is simple, people are complex.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty obsessed with human behavior, and feeling and gut feeling and instinct and all of these terms. And perhaps, you know, if people gone back when people, I used to say to people, when you go through an airport, you'll see a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. Yeah. Guy won the Nobel Prize for economics for trying to understand how we process. Yeah. It can be quite dry. I do quite often get people to look at Michael Lewis's book on the friendship between Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, which is about that. But this can be quite a dry topic, because if we look at analyzing and measuring, etc., I guess I'd be more interested in we might want to take the current COVID situation, particularly, I live in the London area and it's pretty savage right now. Mm. But how does there is the, okay, putting it this way, and I'm rambling a bit. modern philosophy was is driven by a Latin phrase of I think, therefore I am.
Yeah.
Right. And I've been putting it out there for quite a few years that I don't believe that's accurate. I think mm-hmm. humans make all their decisions based on how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
They can rationalize first, they can post-rationalize afterwards, but they make decisions based on how they feel. So it's really should be sentio ergo sum.
Yeah.
Now, I'm only an interested and curious amateur who looks to apply it working with leaders.
Yeah.
You're a professional business anthropologist.
Yeah.
I don't know where to go with it, but really, what do we understand? How do you go about understanding people through they learn? I know you've written a book about this.
Yeah. Well, I jump back a bit, actually. I mean, I think, as you sort of say, you know, I think, therefore, you know, I am. Arguably, that's the sort of the original sin. I mean, it would be a bit broad to say that's the original sin of sort of Western thought, but it is certainly a sin, as it were, that is still playing out in the world of business, right? Because what that phrase and the thought that it was wrapped up in created the idea of was that, you know, the body, if you will, is merely a transportation device for our head, for our mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mind from where we can kind of create an objective, detached, kind of rational view of the world. And so, you know, that in turn gave rise to counting machines, which in turn gave rise to computers, which in turn gave rise to big data,
mm-hmm.
And attempts to recreate brains, in the form of artificial intelligence. And I entirely agree, and I agree so much that I spent a while writing a book about it, which is that we also learn with our bodies. We make sense of the world through our bodies in very, sometimes very startling ways. So I talk about an anthropologist who studied minaret craftsmen in Yemen, for whom there was no formal instruction into how to build these very intricate structures, but they literally learned how to do it through their bodies, through observation of others' bodies and practical application of what a repetition of what they were seeing. So from these very practical ways, yes, we learn through our bodies, but also in very cultural ways, we build up knowledge, which, as somebody beautifully put it once, we know more than we can tell. In other words, goes back to the anthropology bit, which is anthropologists are trying to make sense of people's worlds, which for other people make complete sense. They make so much sense you don't even have to think about it, you know. And so what we're trying to do as anthropologists is try and make explicit what for other people needs no mention of, needs no observation about, needs no articulation of, because it just is. And so much of that sort of just is knowledge is knowledge of the body. And I think we've tended over the centuries to trust more of that kind of head first knowledge rather than the body first knowledge, because the body first knowledge feels, you know, too wound up in emotion, too close to feeling rather than fact. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, my sort of book is an attempt to try to sort of restore some balance to that and say we need to think with heads and, you know, minds and bodies. And businesses need minds and bodies. And there are some very practical ways they can do that.
I'm very curious about how we learn, how we understand. And that does seem to drive me in really unusual directions of learning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of them is I met a guy called Aaron Turner in London, who I should get on this show, who heads up a concept called Three Principles. In the UK. And really it's a fairly out there, and this is not to in any way minimize it because I think it's quite powerful, fairly out there thought process that we have to get our head around the fact that, we create all of our own thoughts.
Yeah.
And they're like buses going past and we just keep attaching meaning to them, try to rationalize them.
Yeah.
But our body creates these thoughts all the time. And if we can let go of those thoughts, our body will teach us some wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just tried to explain that reasonably accurately in about 20 seconds. It took me a long time to learn it.
Yeah.
I had to sense it.
Yeah.
And how it applied. So I think for me, why I mentioned him was that he's done in the practical world of business, he's done work providing training and stuff to organizations internally.
Yeah.
Often in hospitality. And when he told me some of the restaurant change hotels and stuff he worked with, I went, that makes perfect sense. Because when I've walked in there, they feel different.
Yeah.
And how do you put a number to that? It just is.
Yeah.
You know, when you walk into them and you, so when you, this goes back for me about 15 odd years ago when I was evaluating businesses for investment and stuff like this. And I would get to this point, it got to be an obsession where I just went, why do these two businesses look the same on paper? But when I walk in the door, they feel different.
Yeah.
And I would invest in one and I wouldn't invest in the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't understand how it works. I simply have experienced it.
Well, yeah, I remember speaking to, I mean, I didn't include this example in my book, but it's also, I spoke to a fund manager about, my book once, you know, just over a beer and he said, yeah, no, I get exactly what you mean. You know, I invest in the hospitality sector. And he said, one of the things I do when I go into a chain owned by one of the fund, you know, one of the pub chains that I'm invested in is, I go straight to the toilets, you know, and what I want to see in there is the place clean. You know, I literally want a visceral feeling of how much the management of that pub care about, you know, the backstage area of their establishment, right? And yeah, and lots of other things besides. So, you know, yes, he's an analyst and, you know, and he's working with teams of people that are running through the numbers. But actually at the end of the day, what really matters, what's going to stand between a pub sort of being successful and not, you know, it's probably be about what's going on in the toilets, you know, does that make it a welcoming place for female customers? So that may not necessarily be that sort of approach may not lead to the most successful investment strategy if that's the only thing you're doing.
Okay.
But, you know, once upon a time, I used to, you know, I bought some shares in Greggs. And every time, you know, I walked past the Greggs, you know, I would see queues of people coming outside, lining up outside. I'd see a product range that kind of made sense for the demographic they were going for. They seemed to clearly understand who it was. And that sort of gave me faith in what I had done, right? And those are signals which, as you say, you know, there's no spreadsheet that can contain those signals. And there's probably no source of data that can really capture, you know, that sense that, yeah, they've got it. They know what they're about. They know who they're for and they're delivering it and doing it successfully. And the staff are really friendly and bubbly on top, right? So, that's an understanding of the world that can only be derived from being in the world. And that's my fundamental hypothesis or premise about what makes great companies and makes good leaders is they take the time to get outside, get out of their building, out of their glass tower and look. And not just look with eyes, but look with their body, feel with their body what is going on.
Embodied learning, right? So,
exactly.
I'm amused at the fund manager example because over a pint of beer or whatever you were having, they still didn't really want to admit to themselves that what they wanted to do was feel it. Yeah. Because you can still measure how clean a bathroom is, right? Yeah. So it's still I resemble this remark because for years and years, it was all about measurement, rationality. With that, this is a terrible time that we're all living through. And at the same time, there are some gifts in the fact that we're all having a certain experience, a feeling-based experience at the same time. Things like talking about mental health and wellness are now, even though they gradually were becoming destigmatized, it's kind of like, okay, everybody feels shit at times here.
Yeah.
Pardon my language. Yeah. But it's, so there is a potential for much more connection to how we experience the world.
Yeah.
Than the much more largely rational way that we would admit to. Yeah. And I'm being generic around this. I've experienced it myself. But what are the, I guess you can go in any direction you like. A few thoughts occur to me for us, for you to, you know, teach us a little bit. Is that what can we do to, you know, beyond this huge interest now in breath work and Wim Hof and stuff like this, which has come out since lockdown, going out for a walk, getting in the fresh air, you know, that, and, your body will teach you, well, this is what you need next, whether it's a cup of tea or a lie down or go back to work. Yeah. But if you sit at your desk all day long going, your remote working desk going, oh God, the world's shit. Is this ever going to change? But what can we learn, or else just what's next? I mean, what will we, I don't know, what's next for you? What's next for the work you'll do? You know?
Yeah. I think what's really, I mean, as you say, sort of at one level, we are experiencing sort of, you know, the same thing, but of course, you know, sadly, you know, we know that COVID doesn't sort of, you know, is quite discriminating, right?
Absolutely.
It's discriminated both in terms of who it's attacked more than others, but also the impact that it's had on particular types of worker and industry sector. Mm-hmm. That said, so, you know, I don't want to sort of suggest, and I know I'm not claiming that you suggested either, you know, there is huge differences.
Yeah, we're not all in it together.
But I think we are all going through the same thing, which, you know, I suppose it's a horrible parallel, but I suppose, you know, Britain went through a world war, you know, we were all kind of in it together. So there is a sort of a shared set of reference points. And I think, so that said, I think for those that are in the knowledge work, i.e. sitting in front of a screen kind of category of worker, one of the bits of sunlight that has been shed on the sort of on how we work and what makes our sort of work effective is that although in many ways it is work of the mind, you know, apart from the bit of tapping and swiping and mouse clicking, I think we've all begun to realize that actually, I think Ian Sanders has a beautiful way of putting it, we do need to take our ideas for a walk. And there is a very significant body of evidence from kind of the cognitive science arena and from the clinical psychiatry and psychology areas that show that we do think with our bodies. You know, we learn to count on our hands, you know, that kids learn more complex mathematical concepts when they are in some way, shape or form performing them. So, so I think what we have all learned is that 8 hours glued to a chair in front of a screen is, of course, not very good for us orthopedically. It's not very good for us creatively. And I think it's brought some fresh light to the importance of air, of space, of walking, of getting out. And when we do so, as again, you know, the evidence shows quite clearly, we are more creative when we go for a walk. And now that you've got a lovely background, I'm not sure you're there, but
no.
You know, the evidence shows that we are more creative when we take our ideas for a walk in green, rural, more natural spaces too. So I think what's really interesting is that we built offices in particular kind of formats and formations with particular types of ideas about how knowledge work gets done, but actually, you know, perforce, you know, we've all had to sort of, you know, experiment with different ways of trying to be better at what we do. And I think it's really interesting that the kind of the body and physicality have kind of have made a kind of a strong showing in that rethinking about how we do our best work.
Well, if I link to that, I looked at the bio of the companies your companies work for, and included in them are some of the ones that are most under fire around influencing human behavior in the world.
Yeah.
And I guess what comes to me, one of them is well known for popularizing the term psychological safety in the workplace. Yeah. And it's interesting for me when I link into that is the key to all relationships is trust, right? Yeah. Can we individually trust that? Can we individually, it was a very interesting piece you said at the beginning was like linking how people behave inside an organization to outside, because then they can be empathic, then they can relate to it.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a past client the other day, he's actually on my show in a few weeks' time, and he's in Canada, right? And they have even less daylight hours than we do, and it's a damn sight colder outside than the UK is. But they refer to sunshine hours.
Yeah.
And so they're encouraging all of their thousands of knowledge worker staff around the country to make sure they get their sunshine hours. Now, it might be pouring with rain. It might be snowing. It might be awful. Yeah. But get some daylight hours, and you know, because you will come back and you'll be more effective. And I've started doing, I was doing this, I mean, as our mutual acquaintance, Ian Sanders, he does a lot. There's a cat on the screen. That's awesome. For the audio viewers, cat on the screen, for the audio listeners. So Ian believes in he's been doing it for ages, like with a methodology he has around the running coaching sessions while walking.
But I
love walking meetings. And I did one for an hour and a half today with a client. And actually we said, you know what, I've got some notes. We can go through it on Teams or Zoom, or we can go for a walk. And we do it virtually right now because of the lockdown restrictions. So we basically have earbuds in and walk in different parks about 4 or 5 miles apart. But it's such a different conversation when you do that.
And again, as I said, I mean, you know, what's brilliant is I think that there is so much evidence, you know, instinctively or, you know, your experience of that is that it works better. You know, there's, as I said, plenty of evidence to suggest why that is, you know, because actually, you know, our bodies do play a role in our thought processes, right? And, and all of these attempts to kind of reduce thinking to, you know, or to equate what happens in the brain with what happens in a computer. You know, the first computers were called electric brains, you know, misses the point, right? Which is that we are in and of the world through our bodies, of which our brains are part of our bodies. But we need to use both of them. And, you know, we're doing a lot of work with one of our tech company clients around collaboration. And I think, you know, and the tools for that. And again, as we all know, you know, often it's easier to stand in front of a wall with a colleague and think, with them, think again through our bodies with material artifacts like post-it notes, which in a sense are our extended mind, right? And I talk in the book about this phenomenon in linguistics called shared utterance, which is essentially the idea, you know, you probably had the experience, we probably done it in this call where one person finishes the end of another person's sentence, right? And more often than not, you actually say the thing that they were intending to say, or you even use the same word that they were intending to use. Often you don't. And so what you get is a kind of a build on a thought that when you finish a sentence, you take it in a slightly different direction for somebody, and on you go, and it ladders. And again, there's very good evidence that this is actually kind of a physiological property. So this occurs actually most effectively when we are together. And it creates real challenges when we're trying to do this work, you know, through a rectangular screen. So, you know, I'm super interested in these kind of physical resonances between bodies, you know, which have been seen in nature, you know, entrainment. You know, you see it with organ pipes that start to take on the sound of the one next door. You see it with fireflies. You see it with crowds. You know, crowds don't have conductors, but they behave as if somebody is. That is essentially a form of entrainment. It's a form of social contagion that's very physical in where it's coming from.
So I guess the if we look at one area, which is if we're going to whatever goes on, there'll be a lot more online interaction.
Indeed.
Before is if we can learn, if we can accept this, because, you know, I have a thought process around the advances in neuroscience and saying we're still at the point where, you know, we've gone from examining the brain by slicing through the brains of cadavers to functional MRIs. But fundamentally, there's still only the resolution of Google Maps, right? That doesn't really tell us something at the cellular level. But if you listen to the ancients and Eastern wisdom or just stuff we've experienced in our own working lives, it just works. So we just try it. So as a facilitator, a small example is if when I do facilitation of group work, it might be round tables and you send them off to talk about something for 10 minutes and you sit and you're in the room listening to the hubbub, to the energy, and you might move around the tables and get a sense if one of them needs some help or if you just want to lean in. One of the things I've been recognizing is that when you send people off to breakout rooms on Zoom, never do that. Just go make a cup of tea, right? Yeah. Because you've no cues as to what's going on for them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that if you just enter the room as the facilitator, you break their flow completely.
Yeah.
So, but people go, no, I always want to go check in on them for a minute a room. I'm going, well, is that about you or about them? Well, it's about you.
Yeah.
But it's actually, if we recognize that, and the other one you mentioned was, post-it notes, the sort of classic, you know, facilitation exercise, get people to put things up. And last time I did that, being from the Cayman Islands, was against a glass wall overlooking the Caribbean. And that's an interesting creative vibe. And when you've got people doing that, I just suddenly went back to that physical experience of when you're part of that, because I've been part of that as well as a facilitator, is people are holding a post-it note and they're trying to decide whether to go first with it, where to go next, whether to lean in, what to write on the next one.
Yeah.
And it's a hugely physical experience.
People
get out of their head entirely. They watch the flow of the group.
Yeah.
And they stop. They don't overthink it. They just go for it. Once you recognize the value of that collaboration, it's then, well, we are going to be in not a remote first, but there will be this ability to do it. How can we not copy what we do, but how can we, if we raise the context, the different forms of learning and collaboration, that's a fascinating field you're seeing. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we use a lot of mural boards. And I think what's interesting is that those do a very good job of, as it were, recreating, you know, the world that we were familiar with. But what they haven't yet kind of nailed, and I think, you know, this is going to produce a great fluorescence of interesting innovation in this kind of collaboration space, is they haven't really seemed to be able, they don't currently reproduce some of the tactility and the physicality of the interactions, but they're also actually, you know, and I guess they're probably working on it, and I'm working on it with some of our clients, is thinking, well, what are the benefits? What are the affordances of this world that actually we can kind of almost take a leap over, you know, in the way that African countries leapt over copper wire to mobile?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what are the ways in which
industrial revolution stuff,
we can kind of leapfrog this stuff? So I think it's you know, yes, it is challenging. And at the moment, we're still in this kind of making sense of making it work mode. I think, you know, we are going to get into some really interesting spaces. And I think one of the interesting spaces is about how we manage hybridity, you know, so how do we manage in this time when some people are in the office and others aren't? And I absolutely think that is where we're going to be in, you know, however many months time, and that will continue. And that will throw in really interesting challenges for how organizations operate.
Well, before we came on, we were talking about serendipity and how we both had to go at Lunch Club, which is quite cool. And, one of my earlier guests who I met through a community called Liminal, which is all about transition. It's a phrase, a word I quite love. Is a guy called Stephen Hicks, who his current commercializing project out of Oxford is around bringing sight to the unsighted using goggles and stuff. Yeah. The thing he was talking about on the show as well, though, he's really getting into, is the idea of 3D avatars for people. Which isn't, you know, it brings that quasi physicality to the online world. So it's absolutely fascinating. You might want to have a look at the recording or listen to the podcast and I'm happy to introduce you and you can chat.
I'd love to see that. Yeah. So I'm really interested at the moment in, sort of porting. I mean, I talk a bit in the book about kind of embodiment and our interactions with computing, but, I'm really interested to kind of, you know, dig deeper into that and think about where things are going in, you know, a disembodied, you know, rectangular world. There are lots of traces of embodied interaction with computing already amongst us, smart speakers, you know, AR glasses or what have you. But, but I think we're about to reach a really interesting kind of phase transition in the technology world towards more, more innovation in and around embodiment, in a way that will help us kind of exist in this kind of hybrid world, if you will. So I think lots of interesting creative innovation will come out of this.
One of my other guests, because this is like I think my 26th show, is a guy called Chris van der Kyle, who's an entrepreneur, and his business is heavily involved in Minecraft. And he's been a gamer. He's you know, a few years younger than me, and I'm 55, right? But not many years younger. And he's been a gamer since the ZX80 and before, right? The early computers. I would imagine if we got him on, I mean, the gaming community, the people who run those companies, they're fascinated by where all this can take us. They'll probably be way ahead of the regular world.
Yeah.
It's like,
Well, I mean, the latest VR headsets are, you know, and I'm somewhat skeptical about VR at some levels, but, you know, they are jaw-droppingly good. And I think, whilst knowledge workers are probably not going to want to spend, multiple hours a day kind of in Vail, as it's known in the industry, I think there is some really interesting, there's a really interesting future there for VR. You know, if it can achieve kind of the breakout, you know, and I can imagine that physicality of a workshop, being one place where, you know, things will start to get interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're just beginning to scratch the surface of it.
Exactly.
And, I'm trying to encapsulate certain things is, I'm just personally super energized by the idea of understanding how humans learn. Because it has so many applications as to how, you know, that can then make a difference in so many different ways. And yes, I think when you put it that phrase of I think the where I am is the original sin. The other piece, I'm also a profoundly passionate amateur economist.
Yeah.
And the original sin is to talk about rational actors.
Absolutely.
Right. Because the entire world of economics is based around the concept that we're rational.
Yeah.
So if, you know, I guess I'll leave you with a closing thought as I do for my guests. I was about to kind of wrap that up, but I won't. So what are your closing thoughts for this and for the podcast that lives forever?
What are my closing thoughts? I would say if you're in business, whether that's a leader of a business or a leader of teams or wherever you are in your career, I think the drift for many, many businesses is one inwards. It's one where they think more about themselves, about their politics, their process, and not so much about the world, the people that they serve. So I think if in doubt, go out into the world. If in doubt, take your team into the world with you, and think in kind of structured ways before you go out into the world about how you are going to try to experience that world, right? So this isn't about just going out with a notepad and looking. This is about ways of trying to embody a world. So, you know, think creatively about how you can create experiences for yourself or for your team that will bring them closer to the worlds of people that you're seeking to serve. It's not as difficult as you think, and anyone can do it. So it's a highly democratic opportunity.
So, and your book is called The Power of Not Thinking.
How our bodies learn and why we should trust them.
So I guess my mentor for years has a tagline on our email signatures: awareness is the greatest agent for change. Absolutely. So I'm hearing, be more conscious in how you experience the world. So I just wrapped up myself, so naughty boy. Okay, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Serendipitous and very interesting, Simon. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye, babe.